journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, July 22nd, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
The Indian Parliament holds a confidence vote sparked by a nuclear deal with the U.S. Trade representatives gather for another round of WTO talks in Geneva, and Christians United for Israel holds its third annual convention in D.C. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. In what is being called a make-or-break meeting, the latest WTO gathering in Geneva could be the impetus for a new world trade pact. More than 30 trade officials have gathered in the Swiss city for a week-long session of the World Trade Organization that could end the so-called Doha round of talks. Associated Press has described the seven-year conflict between rich and poor nations thus. Developing countries want rich ones to open their markets for food and to cut farm subsidies. In return, rich countries are demanding that developing countries cut tariffs on industrial goods and services. Now, the European Union has promised to slash farm tariffs by 60%. Even U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab has promised to cut U.S. farm subsidies. The context of these barely reported talks is ongoing global economic insecurity, including rising food and gas prices. Even though the concessions by wealthy nations sound positive, the president of Oxfam America says that, quote, what's currently on the table falls far short of what is needed and continues to prioritize the interests of rich countries. Locking in big tariff cuts without adequate safeguards in place will only expose poor farmers to more shocks. My guest this morning is Gawain Kripke, the policy director with Oxfam. Welcome to Uprising, Gawain.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. Let's first lay the background of what's happening in Geneva today. Explain for our listeners what the Doha round of talks exactly is and what specifically poor nations, particularly the large developing countries like India and Brazil, want.
The Doha round of negotiations is a very big, broad negotiation between all the countries that are members of the WTO, about 150 countries, to reform trade rules. After the WTO was created, many developing countries realized that they were being mistreated by the global trade system and felt like they weren't getting the benefits that they had been promised. And so this contributed to the collapse of negotiations in Seattle. You probably remember the uprising that happened in Seattle in 1999. And then in 2001, the Doha round was launched with an explicit purpose of reforming trade, global trade rules, so that developing countries and poor people can benefit. Now we're 7 years later, and those negotiations have basically bogged down and deadlocked, and they haven't moved forward in several years. So in Geneva this week, negotiators are meeting to try to break through the deadlock and make progress on the trade negotiations.
Now, why is it just 30 trade officials instead of what you would expect, over 100?
Well, you can understand that negotiating between 150 people is a very difficult task. So they try to invite representatives of different blocks of countries, different blocks of interest. Exporting countries, manufacturing countries, high-tech countries, poor countries are all supposed to be represented. There's a problem in that because there are many countries that aren't well represented and who feel like they may not get a good deal. So it's a dangerous strategy to invite only a few countries to negotiate, and yet it's also difficult to invite everybody and expect to have real negotiations.
So let's talk about what wealthy nations are promising, particularly, of course, the United States and the European Union. On the one hand, poor countries do want the wealthy nations to open their markets to food from poor countries and cut farm subsidies domestically. And on the other hand, Oxfam is saying that at least the promises are not going far enough.
That's right. Well, in trade, we all participate in trade in some way, in the clothes we buy or the computers we use. But for developing countries and for poor people, agriculture is by far the most important area of the economy and the most important area of trade. More than 70% of the poorest people on Earth are involved in agriculture. So agriculture markets are critically important to the livelihoods of poor people. And that's why the negotiations have really focused on agriculture trade, because that has the most opportunity but also the most risk for developing countries and poor people. What developing countries want is the opportunity to trade in agricultural products. That's what poor people in developing countries can produce. They want the European Union and Japan and the United States to open our markets so that they can export products into our markets and earn money. And they also want rich countries like the United States and the EU to stop subsidizing agriculture, making a very unfair competition between poor farmers and farmers in our country.
So if the European Union has promised to slash farm tariffs by 60%, I mean, that's going above and beyond what they've promised in the past. Is that not a good thing?
Well, it's progress, but the thing is that these negotiations are very complicated, and the structure of commitments in the negotiations is Byzantine. It's like a maze. And so you can make a statement like cutting tariffs by 60%, but when you actually analyze it, that's not really what happens. So not to get into too much detail, but you really have to investigate what is meant when statements are made about cutting tariffs by 60%. Right now, what's on the table in the negotiations wouldn't provide very much opportunity to developing countries for new markets and new trading opportunities, at the same time as what's on the table wouldn't actually reduce the trade distorting subsidies that the European Union and the United States impose on agriculture, and that hurts developing countries.
My guest is Gawain Kripke, a policy director with Oxfam. We're talking about the latest gathering of the World Trade Organization in Geneva. More than 30 trade officials representing various countries and blocs have gathered to try to resolve the so-called Doha round of talks that began several years ago in Doha, the capital of Qatar. So let's talk about whether these poor nations, or developing countries as they're called, are united. I mean, you mentioned that there are representatives that represent blocs rather than individual countries. There are enormously big countries with powerful economies like Brazil and India, and then, of course, smaller nations such as many smaller poor nations in the continent of Africa. Are poor nations united on what they want, or relatively united on what they want from wealthy nations?
The answer is yes and no. Almost all developing countries share the same critique and expectations of what the United States and Europe and Japan and other developing countries should do. They all think that rich countries should open their markets more for poor countries and that they should stop distorting agricultural markets with our subsidies. But beyond that, there are differences. Some bigger countries like Brazil and India and China are much more capable and have a lot more interest in the trading system, whereas a lot of the poorest countries in Africa and South Asia really don't trade that much and are mostly very defensive. They're very worried about the way in which trade can hurt their markets, can hurt their people. So there are some differences in how these countries approach trade, whether they see them as mostly an opportunity or mostly a risk. And So you do see some differences in the negotiating approach, and yet most of the developing countries have banded together to have joint positions and are mostly negotiating as a bloc. Like I say, on some specific issues, there are some differences, but in general, there's a lot of consensus about what should happen.
Now, here in the United States, are policies that dictate how much subsidy to give to the agribusinesses is what's specified in the so-called farm bill. And and your organization, Oxfam, has a critique of the recent farm bill here in the United States as it relates to international trade. What happened here in the United States, and how does it how can it impact these negotiations?
Right. Well, the United States has a system of farm subsidies that's called the Farm Bill, and Congress passes a Farm Bill about every 5 years. And it sounds good. I mean, most people would like to support farmers, in this country, and so it seems like a reasonable thing to do. Unfortunately, the reality of the Farm Bill doesn't do much for most farmers. In fact, it's only about a quarter of U.S. farmers that receive any support from the Farm Bill, and most of those are very big, very commercial operations. The smaller farmers, the ones who are trying to do innovative farming practices like organic farming, they don't really get anything out of the Farm Bill. It's mostly the big sort of commercial agribusiness farms that are getting massive amounts of subsidies. So our problem with the Farm Bill is that it's not what it's advertised to be. It doesn't really help most farmers, and it doesn't help farmers in the way that most people think it should, which is to help small farmers who are struggling. Rather, it provides massive subsidies for very big operations. So we were hoping that the Farm Bill that Congress passed this year would be a reform, would be moving away from the big, massive trade-distorting subsidies and towards support for smaller agricultural enterprises, more innovative enterprises, more focused on health and safety and environmental stewardship. Unfortunately, Congress passed a very bad Farm Bill that does almost no reform and also gets in the way of these trade negotiations that are supposed to help developing countries.
And Oxfam just put out a report about the Farm Bill as it relates to the trade negotiation. Square Pegs and Round Holes is the title of that report, How the Farm Bill Squanders Chances for a Pro-Development Trade Deal. You quote Representative Colin C. Peterson in this report. He said there's pressure on us to change the Farm Bill because that's the only way we can get a trade deal. Now, I'm sorry, but I've had enough of these trade deals, and unless we can get something good out of it, I don't give a darn if we get one. Now, Gawain, what is this? What does this mean? And does the U.S. not stand to gain from getting a good deal, whether it's in favor of farmers or not?
Yeah, this is one of the sad points about trade and agriculture, which is that agriculture is a very important economic driver in developing countries. But in the United States, agriculture is pretty small. It's really about 2% of our economy, and about less than 2% of our workforce is involved in agriculture. Most of our economy is in services and manufacturing. That's where our interests are, and that's where most of our jobs are. And yet the whole trade negotiation is focused on agriculture, which is really a sliver of our economy, and it's holding up progress in other areas where many more jobs are possible for Americans. So the Agriculture Committee in the Congress has basically held up progress in opening markets for the United States and for opening markets for developing countries. It's really a logjam, and it's very sad because it means economic progress both here and in very poor countries is going to be held up.
Now, I had quoted U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab saying that U.S. farm subsidies would be cut. At least she's saying this for the purposes of this meeting. What does that mean?
Well, there's promises and there's promises. The United States has promised to make cuts, but the cuts that they're proposing are actually of theoretical subsidies, not actual subsidies. In WTO, the commitments are what you're allowed to do, but not what you actually do. And so we're willing. U.S. has promised to cut what we're allowed to do, but not actually cut what we do in terms of providing subsidies. And likewise, the European Union has promised to cut what they're allowed to do in terms of tariffs on agricultural products, but not what they actually do.
So it's like cutting theoretical subsidies, but not existing subsidies.
Exactly. And that's one of the criticisms, is that developing countries will be required to make actual cuts and actual sacrifices, whereas most rich countries will be made to make theoretical cuts rather than real cuts. So the economic impact will be much bigger on developing countries.
Now, Oxfam has said that a fair trade deal is needed more than ever. But in the context of the food crisis globally, given the enormous amount of starvation and suffering, particularly in poor countries as a result of this food crisis, all of these negotiations are based on the premise that poor countries should be growing food for export, which is exactly the opposite of what is needed to solve the food crisis problem. What are the representatives of these poor countries doing to address this, and are they trying to reverse the current system of growing food for export, and what does Oxfam say about it regarding fair trade?
Right. Well, we are in the middle of a global food crisis. Food prices have increased dramatically in the last 6 years and have accelerated rapidly just in the last year. We're hearing about it all over the world, where poor people are facing more and more trouble getting enough food and buying enough food on markets. So we do have a very big challenge in front of us. You said that there's a problem in growing food for export, and I think there's some truth in that. But there's also a lot of opportunity in growing food or other products for export. And the best solution is probably a mixture of growing for domestic markets, but also growing for export. Many developing countries now depend on food imports to provide food for their population. And that's not all bad, but it's also not all good. What has happened over the last 30 years is that agriculture in the poorest countries has declined rapidly. Agricultural productivity has not kept pace with population, and so many poor people are more dependent on buying food on markets, and many developing countries are more reliant on importing food. And we do want to reverse that trend. We want to make sure that poor people and developing countries can produce their own food, or at least produce a higher proportion of it. But how do they get the resources to make those investments? Well, one of the things that they can do is trade. And so coffee farmers in developing countries in Ethiopia or Uganda or Costa Rica or Colombia should be able to trade their coffee to earn money so that they can make investments.
And that's where fair trade comes in.
That's where fair trade comes in, and that's mm-hmm. and being fair about giving opportunity is what we think the trade round should be: giving more opportunity, giving higher values to the farmers, rather than getting all the benefits to agribusiness or to middlemen. That's really the goal of making trade fair for developing countries and for poor people.
Very briefly, Gawain, are any of the trade representatives of the poor nation blocs talking about fair trade, or is that just too far off for them to even consider asking?
You know, talking about fair trade, which is the system by which consumers make commitments to buy goods that are produced with ethical values and with higher returns for the farmers, this comes up a lot in the discussion of trade, but almost never in the trade negotiations. Mostly it's a consumer action or a consumer action connected with producers. And there are ways that we think that the system can be improved so that fair trade has more advantages. But right now it doesn't come up hardly at all in these negotiations. They barely touch on these issues.
Well, Gawain, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for covering the issue. I think it's important.
I think so, too. Absolutely. Gawain Kripke is the policy director with Oxfam America, and you can find out more at their website, oxfamamerica.org, where you can also download their new report, Square Pegs in Round Holes, which is the title, How the Farm Bill Squanders Chances for a Pro-Development Trade Deal. The mini-ministerial of the World Trade Organization happening currently in Geneva is the topic of this first conversation this morning. Lots more conversation to come after this break. We'll talk about what's happening in India. Will go live to New Delhi to find out about a confidence vote in the Indian Parliament over the U.S.-India nuclear deal. And at the end of the hour, we'll talk about protesters demonstrating outside of the annual summit of Christians United for Israel. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. A nuclear deal between India and the United States has sparked serious instability within the Indian government. After more than 3 years of negotiations over a U.S.-India nuclear agreement, the Indian Parliament today held a vote of confidence in the coalition government led by the Congress Party. The vote was called by Prime Minister Manmohan Singh after the two leftist parties in the coalition pulled their support of the U.S.-India nuclear deal, saying that it would make India subservient to U.S. policy. If the deal goes through, it would ostensibly provide India with access to American civilian nuclear technology in exchange for nuclear-armed India agreeing to oversight by the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. The deal, as it's simply called in India today, is a legacy builder for Singh, with one reporter claiming no Indian prime minister has ever staked his government's future so completely and so unilaterally like Mr. Singh has. The confidence vote is so close that six parliamentarians currently serving prison sentences for various crimes were temporarily freed to take part in the vote. Lawmakers recovering from illnesses and even surgery were flown in for the vote. Emotions ran high with the chief minister of one state, Uttar Pradesh, claiming that the deal makes India a, quote, slave of the United States. The Bush administration is keen on finalizing the nuclear deal before the president's tenure ends at the end of the year. Joining us live from India, from New Delhi right now, is Badri Raina. He is a former professor at Delhi University, a very prolific writer and a columnist for Znet. Welcome to Uprising, Badri.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for joining us. So my producer informs me that the very, very latest news, as we were live on the air, it turns out that the result is that the Indian government won the confidence vote.
Yes, that's true. A difference of 19 and 10 abstaining. But I must also say that this is a very, very dark day for parliamentary democracy in India, because just after the speeches were over, three BJP MPs with very shady backgrounds, who have earlier had difficulties in money laundering and things like that, produced a sum of 3 crores in Parliament House and accused the opposition, where in this case the government phalange, of actually bribing them.
And the BJP is the Bharatiya Janata Party, which used to be in power.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's right. The opposition BJP. And we don't know exactly what is the backdrop to this. The speaker, of course, called a meeting of all the party leaders, and I think we'll go into a probe. And at this point, it is very, very difficult to say what will come out. But altogether, yes, the government has won the vote. Where it will go from here seems obvious enough now. You ask me what you want to ask.
Well, the vote seemed to be a sort of make or break thing for the prime minister and his party. What led him to stake so much on this vote?
Yes. That's a good question. Actually, let me put it this way, into some context. You see, beginning 1990, you remember the Washington Consensus.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a paradigm shift in India's economic policy and economic thinking. Consider that after the anti-colonial movement, India was to actually give to itself what was called a mixed economy, with the state controlling what Nehru called the commanding heights of the economy. And the state it was that gave to India its educational institutions in science, technology, research, universities, and some of the early bourgeoisie was a national bourgeoisie, which was severely protected by the state against foreign competition and so on and so forth. Now, one of the reasons, of course, this was that India was a very poor country. When we speak now in 2008, what is it, July 22,
mm-hmm.
please remember that according to a report of a committee set up by this government, this is called the Arjun Sen Gupta Committee, a very well-known economist and a member of Parliament of the Congress. The committee, in a fairly detailed report, among other things, produced the finding that as of now, 77% Indians subsist on a daily expenditure of 20 rupees, that's 50 cents, or less. 77% Indians. On the other hand of the spectrum, you have in 2003, we already had 26 billionaires. And over the last 3 or 4 years, that has gone up to 46 billionaires. And other classes that were spawned by the economic reforms of 1990, when the present prime minister was the finance minister. This was the beginning of the neoliberal economic phase in Indian policy making. Now, after all these 20 years, India has spawned a new middle class. And this is a middle class. There's, of course, a generational shift also. India has among the world's largest population of young people, below 25 or something. Now, this is since I'm talking to Radio Uprising, this is an uprisen class which has very faint memories of the anti-colonial freedom movement, which has a social conscience which is non-existent, if you ask me, and whose principal dream is to fulfill the Indian-American dream. I've called it so in one of my articles. Big superpower claims and so on and so forth. Now, this, of course, was aided greatly by the policy that Rajiv Gandhi, the late Rajiv Gandhi, initiated in the IT sector. And as you know today, in the IT services sector, India controls something like 60% of world trade. Now, therefore, after that economic paradigm shift, there has been this consuming desire for another kind of economic shift, which is to go away from non-alignment, Brussels, Beijing, Bandung, and so on, to align with what they think is unqualified terms, the world's only remaining unilateral superpower, namely the United States of America, regardless of Bush or his ratings or what he has been doing in the world, and supported massively by this very influential NRI segment.
The non-resident Indian segment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the non-resident Indians in America. And therefore, they have been arguing, you know, it's time to forget about the old world Nehruvian the social conscience. By the way, the preamble of the Indian Constitution also has the word secular and socialist democracy, which is now a bit of a joke. And to go full forward to register new GDP growth, new departures in technology, and this is a massively consumerist upper middle class, with the income disparities, which, as I suggested to you, are absolutely mind-boggling. Now, therefore, doesn't matter the inflation is double-digit today, doesn't matter the prices are skyrocketing of foodstuffs and so on, doesn't matter the poor people have no health care, have no insurance, doesn't matter that 95% of the laboring belong to the unorganized sector in India. And they have absolutely, they're completely out of any kind of network, social network, or social security network. It doesn't matter. These things will take care of themselves. Of course, this thinking is also, Sonali, you must understand, in India's very peculiar cultural history, it's also aided very much by another kind of philosophical challenge, which is this whole karma theory. In other words, we've had our own variety of Hindutva Calvinism, as I've called it somewhere or the other, which is to say that, you know, after all, people come and bring with them their own past karmas, and the government can do only so much. And we have been in the middle of a phase, free tradism, 19th century England, where the theory is that the state has no business in corporate life, except, as in your case currently, what is that, Freddie May and something?
Fannie Mae
or whatever and so on. When the corporates are down in the dumps and need help, then of course the state must come forward. But otherwise the state must leave the corporates and business activity completely free. And if profit margins are maximizing, skyrocketing, all the better. Should any of that go into welfare activity? Well, Nehru thought so, but we don't think so. And this is the way to go. And a third aspect to this, of course, is the military aspect. Now, I would say that from day one, Manmohan Singh and the corporate India that supports this government and on the one side, and the left on the other side, have been very clear from day one that the nuclear deal or civilian nuclear deal arrangement and so on is really not about the civilian nuclear deal arrangement. They've been clear from day one. The left, as you know, does its homework. And they understood that this was, of course, an attempt for the first time openly and unabashedly to draw India into what they call a strategic partnership with the United States. Of course, there were other, which had other aspects to it, as you must have read, this whole notion of, and some of that is in the Hyde Act, that there will be close military cooperation in the South Seas, the quadrilateral thing that they call it, Australia, Japan, America, India. Of course, for America, this is a wonderful way of obtaining some kind of hegemonic hold in this part of the world.
Hmm.
And there will be interoperability in terms of military controls, to a point where a document also suggests that in order to make that possible, they will wear the same uniforms as U.S. soldiers.
Hmm.
And of course, and the other factors, whenever allied forces, read American forces, need space here, need facilities here to go to attack this country or that country, then of course those would be made available. This is all documented.
So, Badri, basically what has led to this confidence vote today that the government of India narrowly won is a trend towards wanting to become more and more aligned with, as you've said, the world's only superpower, the United
yes.
States. Of course, this has sparked this enormous debate within India that goes even beyond the nuclear deal itself. What about the position that civil society, particularly those on the left, are taking? And I'm not talking about the communist parties who are in government, but people on the streets, the organized left on the streets. What position do they take on the U.S. nuclear deal?
Well, the interesting thing is, you see, the answer to that is very complicated. There is the organized left, as you know, the communist parties which participate in parliamentary democracy. Then, of course, there's a left that is not part of the parliamentary system,
mm-hmm.
which is involved in anti-state military activity and spreading through various states. We call them the Naxalites or the Maoists. That's the other left.
The Maoists, uh-huh.
Then there is left liberals like me, if you like, who recognize that there is so much and no more that you can do under a certain circumstance, and there are objective conditions in history. But at the least, one would expect that there would be some Keynesian economics, there would be some welfare economics, there would be a role for the state, there would be a more equitable distribution of wealth and investments in the social sector, and so on. And it is because of the pressure from the left, which has been supporting this government for 4 years or more, that you have had schemes over the last year, which, you know, if you look at them independently, have been quite astounding. I mean, the only place in the world where you have a scheme where employment for 100 days is guaranteed to one member of every family who need employment. This is called the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme. It's quite astounding. At a time when jobs are cut everywhere in the world, this probably is the only country where this happened, and it's working. Now, this has resulted in stymieing the migration of the populations that used to take place from the Mufassils and the upcountry towards the major towns and so on. It's had remarkable dividends, undoubtedly. Similarly, there have been other schemes like Bharat Nirman, road schemes, irrigation schemes, increasingly schemes for the minorities, despite fierce, as you know, opposition from the communal fascists. All that because largely the left was supporting this government. Whereas elites, civil society, allied to the corporates, have been screaming that you should get rid of these people, and because they are holding up reforms. By reforms, we know what they mean: privatize education, privatize services, privatize everything. Because the Washington Consensus at the heart of it had one simple point in a detailed document, which was the transfer of wealth from public hands to private hands. Now, this has been held back because of the dependence of the left. And the minute they won the vote, I was listening, and you have the channels, corporate channels. India has a whole host of them now, for example, CNN, IBN. CNN, IBN, and such like, who have been saying, thank God now the left is gone and you have won the vote. Okay, deal is okay, but now you can go full steam and do all the reforms you ever wanted to do. Now, then there is another kind of civil society, which is NGOs, non-governmental organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there you have a very peculiar picture. They do wonderful work, no doubt. But it is the kind of work which is discreet and disparate in a postmodernist type of way. You know, somebody is doing dams, and somebody is doing ecology, and somebody is doing some irrigation somewhere, and so on. And nothing really seems to tie them together. Their connect with the organized left has been really non-existent, largely, because of turf wars, also because of the left's organized left's inability, I think, to democratize itself, as it could have over the years. I've written about that also. Because also sometimes questions are asked about this kind of civil society, its funding, its vested interests, what it actually does and doesn't do. Various government commissions have gone into this question. This constitutes roughly about, we are talking about here, about 20% of India's population. This whole gamut. The rest, as I said, 77% are people who are laboring, who are either in the farm sector or in the unorganized sector, unorganized services sector, or in the mills, which are increasingly closing down. Then there is a middle section, like the BPOs, who live off outsourced jobs. And then there is the corporate elite,
right,
the CEOs and the professionals and so on. And those are exactly the people who are whole hog allied to this whole new idea. And the idea has two facets. One is America has technology. America is a superpower. Two is America may be doing terrible things here and elsewhere, but they have the power. And who should have the power? And three, this is a class of people that tends, if you scratch them under the skin, to be extremely Islamophobic, and therefore would like very much to see India join, rather than join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, rather than build an alternate power center in the East, for example. They would like nothing more better to see than the American Zionist Indian axis, because they're very fascinated with Israel also. Do you know why? Because Israel doesn't ask questions. When something happens to it, it sends its fighter jets and blasts the hell out of its enemies.
Hmm. Well,
so in short, that's the picture.
That leads well into our final story today. We'll be talking about the annual meeting of Christians United for Israel. My guest is Badri Raina, former professor at Delhi University, a prolific writer, columnist for Znet. We've been talking about the confidence vote of the Indian government that took place in Parliament, narrowly won. And of course, now what this means is that the nuclear deal still has to go through the IAEA and still has to be approved by the U.S. Congress before it can be ratified. But President Bush is certainly keen on passing it. Badri Raina, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we will certainly link to your articles on Znet from our website later today. And thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you very much.
We'd love to have you back on to follow up from what happens, particularly given the questions of possible corruption in the vote that Badri announced at the beginning of the story. You are listening to Uprising, and we are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to Washington, D.C. Stay tuned.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. And join us on Feminist Magazine coming up tomorrow as therapist Wendy Maltz will discuss The Porn Trap, the essential guide to overcoming problems caused by pornography. Also, a look at the latest in environmental racism with the polluting warehouse on the South Central Farmers land. All that and more this Wednesday night at 7. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. It's coming up at 9 right here at KPFK. Radio powered by the people.
Hola, this is Hector Elizondo. Sunday evening, July 27th, KPFK will kick off its 50th anniversary at the Ford Amphitheater. KPFK, that's my station and yours, with a history and track record unmatched in radio, and it's powered by the people. My fellow artists and political satirist Culture Clash are headlining the evening, along with KPFK's own Pocho Hour of Power, led by Lalo Alcaraz, creator of the daily comic strip La Cucaracha, and the sizzling music of Mezcla. The performing artists are donating their talent to benefit KPFK Pacifica Radio, an evening of cutting-edge comedy and music under the stars. That's the Ford Amphitheater this Sunday night at 8 p.m. For tickets, please call 323-461-3673 or visit kpfk.org. Reservations for pre-show celebrity reception, please call 818-985-2711, extension 214. Nos vemos, ci vediamo.
Welcome back to Uprising. Tomorrow on Uprising, we'll be joined live in studio by two members of Culture Clash. We'll be talking about the upcoming KPFK benefit this Sunday that I hope many of you will join us for. The group Christians United for Israel, led by controversial Reverend John Hagee, is holding its third annual summit in Washington, D.C. this week. Starting yesterday and continuing through Thursday, the Washington-Israel Summit, as it's called, will feature elected officials like Senator Joe Lieberman. The convention also includes workshops such as the one named Radical Islam in Their Own Words, given by Daniel Pipes and former Senator Rick Santorum. Lieberman's appearance has sparked controversy as he compared Hagee to the biblical Moses at last year's convention. Republican presidential hopeful John McCain distanced himself from the Reverend's politically volatile statements, like the one where Hagee suggested that the Holocaust was divine intervention to return Jewish people to Palestine. The Institute for the Study of Christian Zionism has called on Lieberman and other elected officials to disassociate themselves from the summit in a petition signed by 500 religious leaders. Peace and social justice groups like the Washington Peace Center, Peace Action, as well as Code Pink demonstrated outside the D.C. Convention Center yesterday evening where the gathering is taking place. The groups cite the extremist views against Iran and world religions held by many of the participants. My guest this morning is Malachi Kilbride with Washington Peace Center. Welcome to Uprising.
Yes, hello. That's Malachi.
Actually. Malachi, I'm sorry about that. Malachi, first tell us what happened yesterday evening before we go into the background of this organization and its conventions.
Yes, well, as you pointed out, they have a convention going on this week. Yesterday evening, what was happening was what they called a pastor's dinner. So as Kufi conventioners were leaving.
And again, Kufi is Christians United for Israel.
Correct. And as they were departing the D.C. Convention Center, there was preparations for the pastor's dinner. So a contingent of between 20 and 30 people from various groups were outside protesting, confronting, and trying to engage the attendees of this event.
I want to play for our listeners some sound from last year's convention. This is actually an excerpt from a mini documentary that was posted online called Rapture Ready, the Christians United for Israel Tour.
Therefore, it is time for America to embrace the words of Senator Joseph Lieberman and consider a military preemptive strike against our land to prevent a nuclear Holocaust in Israel.
And that's the voice of John Hagee, who, of course, is talking about attacking Iran at last year's convention. Malachi, let's talk about Christians United for Israel. Give our listeners some background about this organization, how long ago it started, and what their goal is.
Well, it's quite amazing. It's an organization that has an incredible amount of access to the White House and also Congress. And one of the things that's really striking about this is that it's a new organization. It was founded in early 2006. So it strikes me that such a new organization can have such access to the decision makers in our government. And it's an organization of evangelical and fundamentalist Christians who believe that Israel is a country that is blessed and sanctioned by God, and it should have the right to do whatever it has to do to survive, including supporting the taking back of all of the lands that Palestinians are on right now. They also advocate a first strike against Iran, which was the impetus for last night's demonstration. Many people are concerned that Kufi is one of the leading organizations calling for a military strike against Iran.
So the origins of this organization are certainly, it seems, rooted in many of the right-wing fundamentalist and evangelical Christian groups here in the United States who probably campaigned very heavily for President Bush for both terms. Would that be accurate?
Yes, and it goes a little bit further than that. It's actually a confluence of interests. It is the Christian fundamentalists and evangelicals, or the Christian Zionists, but it's also the neocons who were very instrumental in bringing us the Iraq War, and also other right-wing members of Congress and organizations like AIPAC. So you'll see a lot of crossover on the board of Christians United. You'll see people like Gary Bauer and other people involved, like Daniel Pipes, Elliot Abrams, you know, figures that we've heard about for decades now who have been involved with a lot of nefarious military and foreign policy adventures.
Now, the neocons aren't necessarily religious or even fundamentalist or even religious, and yet you're saying that on this organization they're even present on the board of Christians United for Israel, Kufi.
Yes, I mean, they're either on the board or they are very instrumental in working with Kufi and supporting it and are leading the workshops this week. They're working very, very tightly with each other. And I think that's this confluence of interest is what allows Hagee to make these very anti-Semitic statements, like saying that, you know, Hitler had to exist, or his purpose in life was so that the Jews could end up in Israel. And so a lot of these very backward anti-Semitic statements can be made by Hagee, and yet these Zionists and neocons, many of whom are also Jewish, are just able to sort of dismiss that and say, oh, well, you have to look at the whole context of Hagee's life and his statements. And again, beyond this Israel issue, he's made a lot of other very hateful type of statements, like against Catholics, calling the Catholic Church a whore and things like that.
How does the anti-Semitism, how does Hagee's views on the Holocaust fit within his worldview of Christian apocalyptic vision?
Well, I mean, I'm not a theologian, but my understanding of his position and the position of the members of Kufi, they believe that the Messiah, Jesus, will return for the second time only when there is this united Israel and Jerusalem is one city for the Jews, and it's controlled by the Israelis. And they also believe that there will have to be this final conflict, this final apocalyptic war before the Messiah returns. So it's very strange that Jewish people would get together with this Hagee if he really ultimately believes that the Jews, for the most part, will have to be annihilated, except for, I think, 144,000 or something. It's a very strange theology to many people.
My guest is Malachy Kilbride with the Washington Peace Center, one of the organizations demonstrating outside Kufi's annual convention yesterday evening. And certainly many peace organizations are very critical of organizations like CUFI. But Maliki, is this the first time that peace groups have openly targeted this convention? It's only the third convention, but has this happened before in 2007 and 2006?
I ran into some people yesterday evening who said that they were at one last year, and that was probably an informal gathering of people who are very concerned about the issue. So this is like the third one. And I expect that there will be more, considering the legislation that's in Congress right now, H.R. 362, which is calling for an embargo against Iran, which is a very volatile thing that many people will lead to a military response on the part of Iran, because they will be threatened with the cutoff of their oil. 40% of their oil is imported, even though they are a great oil-producing and exporting nation. They have to bring in 40% of their oil.
Now, Maliki, what about the role that this organization plays or can play within presidential politics, particularly as it relates to this year's election? I mean, John Hagee and his connection with John McCain has been raised, although not very much reported in the press, in relation to or in comparison to Reverend Jeremiah Wright's relationship to Barack Obama. But even beyond that, do you see an organization like Christians United for Israel, CUFI, being very influential over the presidential candidates?
Yes, I do. For one thing, one of the purposes of CUFI is to be a rapid response organization to events and other political items. So Hagee is able to promote his agenda, the CUFI agenda, through the huge membership that he has. Thousands upon thousands of people in a rapid response can immediately call Congress on whatever the issue is. At this convention, they are up on the Hill right now visiting members of Congress. So they will have an impact on the presidential debate and also the election, too.
And it's interesting regarding John Hagee, the controversial reverend who heads CUFI. There is or has been a lot of video evidence of his very extremist views, over 100 of which were taken off of YouTube recently, as reported in the Huffington Post, that over 120 videos from YouTube, which depicted the preacher in a very negative light, were taken off as a result of apparent copyright infringement that John Hagee's lawyer brought up to YouTube. So certainly they are trying to clean up this man's reputation. Maliki, where can listeners find out more about your organization and your efforts against CUFI?
Well, the Washington Peace Center has a website. It's washingtonpeacecenter.net. But you people can also go to the United for Peace and Justice website or the Code Pink websites.
Mm-hmm.
But one important thing is that this legislation in Congress, House Resolution 362, must be stopped.
And that's the one on Iran.
That's the one on Iran that's calling for an embargo.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, as a part of the lobbying days through UFPJ, over 50 representatives and senators were contacted in person by people on the Hill going up to speak out against this.
And unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'll link to the information about that bill on our site as well later today. Maliki Kilbride, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Maliki Kilbride with the Washington Peace Center at washingtonpeacecenter.net. You are listening to Uprising. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Susan B. Anthony once said, "I distrust those people who know so well what God wants them to do because I notice it always coincides with their own desires." That's Susan B. Anthony, and that's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked via kpfk.org. Click on programs on the left column and follow the links. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.